Welcome, Investigator. Evil is on the rise. Crime is escalating. Our mission is to eliminate the crime by exposing evil, examine why it manifests, and highlight the brave souls that confront it every day. Join us as we work together to bring justice to every victim. Welcome to All Things Crime. Here's your host, Jared Bradley.
I was starting to say before about the Adam Walsh, and I'm glad I had the break, Jared, there. So Otis Toole became the suspect on that. Yeah. And they cleared that. And I have a personal stake in this. My mom had to put that all together at the end of it. And I was a police explorer there in Hollywood all those years. So I was literally, as a kid, there watching this whole thing evolve and a new set of eyes, you know, unsophisticated eyes watching Adam Walsh evolve. So over the years, I kind of checked on it. Well, they were, and there's a weird anomaly out there in as much as a court decision went out where it said, if the case is so dormant that you have to turn over everything. So all of this is out in the public sector. So I wanted to look at that because of all those myriad of reasons that were out there. But here's the thing. Otis Toole, who was Henry Lee Lucas's partner in these crimes, lots of murders, but, you know, generally discounted because Texas, you know, who was the epicenter with Henry Lee Lucas and Otis Toole, were unable to check all of those. So they put hundreds of homicides onto him. So you throw the baby out with the bathwater and then it gets lost. Okay. Same thing with GSR, same thing with gunshot residue, same thing with bite mark evidence, just throw it all out. That's sort of, and I'm like, you can't do that. Okay. So back to our case in point, Otis Toole says, I killed and did this with a bayonet. And Adam Walsh was, if to refresh everybody or to let everybody know, he's beheaded. They found his head at the end of it. And he severed his head with a bayonet. Well, a bayonet is a plunging implement. That doesn't make any sense. But you wouldn't know that if you cut a lead out to somebody to do that. Well, except for it wasn't a bayonet. It was a Senegalese knife, like a machete, and it's in a green sheath. So I can see Otis Toole thinking he would call it colloquially a bayonet, and they walked that back. Of course, that piece of evidence is lost to time. That's what happens to these multiple agencies. But it's the same sort of small machete that Quint kind of holds over his head. Well, armed with that, he'd say, look, it's very heavy on the front. He describes that. It's lost. Forget it. You're going to cut. I mean, maybe you can write it down and send a picture to him. Certainly couldn't do it 30 years ago and send that out there. And you know, maybe you're going to have a good a detective out there can comprehend that. But man, it's better to have that for the cost of a plane ticket, you know, in a hotel room or something. You're going to get that, you know, memorialized forever. And they're going to make an assessment based on that coming out of it. But how are you going to transmit all of that tidbit of information? If you don't do it, you got bad, you know, data and a bad interview for the rest of perpetuity. You know, it's lost. So that's my point about how concise that stuff has to be. And I never liked that in the FBI, those cutting of leads. And we work as a team. Of course we do. You know, you have to do those things overseas. It doesn't make sense, but man, it's totally lost to it. And PDs do that. They do it all the time. They work, you know, and they go out, they mesh up with it and it's instantaneous. You know, you have somebody coming in, they're your honored guest. You go out and you interview them and it's a bad guy. And that's how Joe Simpson was captured down there, an MBAC case. From, I'm sorry, was it Knotts, Schollmeyer, or was it Crystal Bezlanowicz? I forgot. Crystal, correct?
Yeah, Crystal Bezlanowicz.
Yeah. But that handoff happens, you know, seamlessly. It's just automatically done, right?
Yeah, what Tom's saying, Jared, if I could just add on to that for a second. You know, at NCIS, the exact same thing. We had to send investigative leads, you know, and particularly with the military environment, these guys are training, right? And they're all over the world, so you have to send it to another office. And things get lost. I will say this, you know, and it's in the book, is when we created our cold case squad at NCIS, you know, we got a certain number of agents, right? A handful of agents. And so they did all the leads on all the cold cases. So at least there was synergy, right, from that dozen or so agents. And I think we actually had up to about 20. And so now it is a cold case investigator at least going to do the cold case. Instead of just, and what you lose is better corporate knowledge, right? When we are, you know, like Tom and I over the years, what we would do is send a lead. Now the corporate knowledge is going, they don't have that at the other office. I'll give you just a quick case. It was the Missy McLaughlin case out of South Carolina. A real heinous crime. I mean, five guys sit down on 30 January of 92 and decide to go kidnap a girl, rape her, and kill her. And that's exactly what they did. They all five flee to different areas of the country, right? And we very quickly, you know, get our hands on four of the five. And some of them confess, some of them don't. And we're doing exactly what Tom said. We're shooting investigative leads and we're following it up with phone calls. Hell, that was back in the day with a bag phone, right? I can remember in North Charleston Police Department having this big bag phone to call our office in Detroit to say, hey, we think he's coming there, right? And so to his, I just want to kind of add to what Tom was saying, that with cold cases, you'll see, I think, a lot of people understand that cold case investigators do all the leads. And that's good that they do that, right? They're not farming them out because we don't lose that corporate knowledge.
That's good. Yeah, almost a common operating picture. How about to use a little military or intelligence community parlance? So you have that baseline of knowledge that's right there. And so, who can fault that? That's the best practice, man. It's coming out there. I had a thought while that happened. Imagine that. But so going across the country, we have a ME system, right? We have a coroner system in some other places. You have a crime scene unit in name, and then you go out and they're different. And some of them are on par with the detectives. And like you said, some are not and everything else. But I heard a great line from a podcast I listened to emergency services. And the reason I came up with that is we would get into these hospitals to try to understand where our patient goes to. And the other part of it is we would have an injured person or a potential injury of one of our crime scene workers. How do we get that person the best care possible? So in doing the research on that, I love the line from it because things have emerged over time. And they said, if you've seen one medical services system, you've seen one medical services system. So stealing that, if you've seen one forensic unit, you've seen one forensic unit. Yeah. You just don't know. Did they have an MBAC? Yes or no? And I put that as the gold standard up here. Did they have NIBIN? Can they explain to you how they're taking and getting those shell cases viewed, or do they look at you and go, huh? Or we just send it to, and man, you just don't know what you get on the other side. There should be a standard because across the country, there's a standard for, you can't just open a door and say, hey, I'm a pediatrician, you got to have some standard. So we're getting there. We're getting there. Yeah. I think us types tend to look at things critically and that comes across as negative, but these discussions are good. They're intense. They're sometimes critical, but that's how we boil out the best practices and how we make each other better, and putting feelings aside and stuff like that. So that's what makes for really good solutions. And people go, oh, I never knew.
Yeah,
I think that brings us right back.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Joe. No, I was just going to say, the capabilities vary. If you have a major metropolitan police department or sheriff's office, a lot of that capability exists, whether they've got an MVAC or they have NIBIN terminal or working on down. Do they have their own DNA lab? Like, I'll take Charlotte Mecklenburg here in North Carolina. They have their own DNA lab capability. But then you get out in some of the rural areas, guess what? I mean, they have nothing, right? So they're relying, just in my state, some of the smaller police departments and sheriff's offices, they're having to drive shell casings sometimes 30, 40, 50 minutes away to have a larger office, make those entries. And, I don't know. I know ATF's tried to get some mobile NIBIN vans out to, address some of that in some states. And I think we've done that here once or twice. But, the capability is always what is a person's capability? Because that makes the difference of whether cases get solved or not. And I will tell you this, that you can see that in unsolved cases, right? And it runs the gamut. I mean, you may have a fully staffed, great forensic unit, department that's, big with money, and they still got unsolved cases, right? And then you may have this small little department with no resources and they've got an unsolved case. So it really, there's no reason. I mean, when you try to drill down why this case go cold, a lot of cases, a lot of different reasons, but I will say that you see fewer cold cases in areas where they have dedicated forensic support and what I refer to as great crime scene investigators, right? Folks that are trained, folks that have education, right? Masters in forensic, they're just better at doing the job and they're going to find the evidence. They're going to take the time. If I had my way, Jared, not just because it's your machine, but I would say, hey, every department should have a damn MVAC. Right. Every department should have a NIBIN terminal, but that's just not reality. Right. But I think,
oh, come on now, Joel, should be reality.
I mean, it should be, because when you think of, the amount of money that is spent on other police functions. Right. And I think you'll see that a lot of times that, and I don't know, Tom may not agree with this, but what I see is some departments do not invest in forensic capabilities, right? They dedicate money to other locations. Yeah. And right now we're struggling. And one of the problems that is even exacerbating this is that we're struggling with getting folks to even want to come into the career anymore. So we actually have departments here in North Carolina, some of the larger departments, they are so decimated with manpower that they're having to take some of their detectives and actually have them perform road functions or patrol functions, you know, to just be able to cover the staffing requirements, right, of responding to current crime. And so and that's not that uncommon. I mean, not only here in North Carolina, but in other southern states, you'll see it's really hard to get qualified folks. And we're even dropping the level, right, of requirements and backgrounds of people. And we still can't get people to come in the door. So there's some challenges that we're going to have to work through as a, you know, as a profession going forward for sure. And I'm like, I hope Tom's right. If the 60s, if he was reading, there was a lot of passivity going on. That gives me hope, right? Because I hope at some point the pendulum is going to swing back to where we're going to start holding people accountable to.
Don't forget
one last thing, the prosecutors here too. I will tell you that if you look across the board, and you may get some phone calls from some prosecutor who gets mad at me saying this, but they are risk averse. They are not prosecuting people the way they used to, and they don't want to. And it's and I don't know why. I mean, I think that I've seen that a huge downturn in the last 10 years of cases. 10 years ago, a prosecutor would roll the dice. It's circumstantial. Let's do it. We think they did it. Let's roll the dice. Those prosecutors today, oh, no way I would try that case. So it's a lot of different things going on here that folks should be aware of.
Yeah. And it's a golden moment here for forensics. So I can go online and see jobs. They're trying to lateral transfer people and they're offering all sorts of bonuses, like you said. So I kind of quipped this one. So there's 300 agencies vying for one police officer. Contrarily, I spoke to a PD last week, medium-sized out there. They had 300 applicants for one forensic. Yeah, I'm stunned. 300 applicants. And you're not even getting that. You're probably 300 cops down. It's just the way things are. Nobody wants to be on the blame line. And, you know, as the adage goes, you can get somebody into combat once. Because once they get shot or they, you know, don't, the VA doesn't take care of them or they're told they're gold brick, they're done. They're done. It's the ingratitude and everything else. And they go to trial, you know, accused of this. So something has to stem this. And I think we're starting to see shades of that coming into, because you have to. You have to protect the guys or they're not, they can't do anything. And what are we going to do? Just turn it over? The biggest bullies happen. And I said, I work, be careful here, Indian country, but that's what happens. And we saw that with the takeovers of the reservations. If you don't have some kind of oversight, you don't provide some kind of relief, the bullies take over. They take over and that's a small, you know, or take it as a nation. That's what happens when you don't, there's no rule of law. There's an agreement how to do business. They just take over. And eventually you're going to get an effect where, well, over history, vigilante crews take over or what happened out in Missouri that Ken McLemore, I'm trying to remember his name, where everybody shot the guy, you know, in broad daylight, I think is what it's called, is the book. But a bunch of townsmen shot this guy and you see crazy stuff like that. And now you've hit a really low tipping point. And I don't know if the country really needs to go there. We can fix this thing, get it on track, but it's going to take a little bit of clawing its way back to get the police protected. What I see some kind of police protection act being passed where they're like, you can videotape all you want, but you're going to provide a buffer zone of 30 feet and you're going to stay back from that and let them do their work. You're not going to interfere in this. And it's going to be, you know, somehow regulated. It's probably going to come from a southern state. It's just that's just probably how I see it, cutting edge.
You know what? That's a rabbit hole that we can hour and a half to talking about. But Joe, back to your book, man. There's one particular line that really caught my eye, especially with as much as the MVAC's involved with DNA. It says gumshoe work precedes DNA evidence. So why don't you explain that a little bit?
Well, I think what I mean in that reference, Jared, is simply that, you know, way before DNA evolved, we had to be a gumshoe detective, right? And that's, hey, how much tenacity do you have? How persistent are you? Do you have common sense, right? And I think a lot of people don't realize that good detectives are gumshoes. And part of that would be that that gumshoe should know everything they can about DNA, right? Not just have to rely on the forensics or the CSIs, but gumshoe detectives, you know how it is, it's so difficult to know how to anything about death, right? I've been doing this many years and there's so many things I don't know because there's so many things to know about death investigation. But one thing is, before DNA ever came onto the scene, you know, Tom mentioned Dave McCraney earlier when we were chatting before you went on, you know, as a retired FBI agent. And he worked on arguably one of the first DNA cases in the country there in Quantico. It's the Lindsey Scott case, if you Google it or research it. And, you know, before that, we paid a lot of attention to fingerprints. I will say that I see from my vantage point, Tom may disagree, is a lot of crime scene units, there's an over-reliance on DNA. In other words, if I get a smudged fingerprint, I still may be able to get some DNA out of that unidentifiable print that's smudged, right? Can't use it to identify anybody, but I still might be able to scratch the DNA out of it. And so that's what I mean by that is we should not totally rely on DNA. It is our best weapon, right? I think arguably anybody said it is the gold standard for any prosecutor today. The only thing that's equivalent to it would be a fingerprint. But that's what I mean by you can't just rely on the DNA. It should be, you know, it's like your most valuable player. There's no doubt on your team that DNA, if you get it, man, that's what we want. But don't stop your investigation, right, on the DNA. And don't think I'm only going to make this case from a DNA standpoint. What we want, what I like in cases is exactly what the prosecutors are after. And that's I want some DNA. I want some fingerprints. I want some good witness statements. And I want the person to confess or tell the truth as to what happened. And if you got all three of those, you're rarely ever going to lose a case. I can promise you that. And so that's what I mean by that is the gumshoe is lost. Here's what I mean, Jared. The detectives today are extremely bright. They grew up in an internet digital world environment. I think they're smarter than the detectives of my generation. I really do, because I think they have more knowledge, or they have the ability to have more knowledge. What I think is lacking is sometimes the interpersonal skills that they're so used to doing things that are technologically based, right? That they don't think about, hey, I got to be a gumshoe. I got to knock on one more door. I got to interview one more witness, right? I got to find one more piece of evidence. And that's what I mean by that. I don't mean to be too long-winded here, but don't just rely on physical evidence to solve your cases. It's three things we got to find to solve them. And it should, that's how you should go out of the gate, because you're going to see some people in this era or there's an over-reliance on technology. Now here's now the irony of that is, think about this. There's not an over-reliance on the MVAC. Oh my God, why are people not, right?
Thanks for joining us. Your attention today brings us one step closer to exposing and eliminating the evil that brings crime to our communities. Hit subscribe and share this episode. Together, we will bring justice to every victim.